Hi there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about Kabul Carnival, Gender Politics in Post-War Afghanistan by Yuli Biao. The book is published by University of Pennsylvania Press, and Yuli is a researcher at the Max Planck Institute of Social Anthropology in Halle. The book is a really fascinating account of women and the state and the ongoing reconstruction projects in post-war Afghanistan. It moves through places such as gender empowerment training programs, women's dormitories, and analyzes topics such as the law and veiling in public. It's really subtle and engaging and a rare and much needed anthropological insight into women's lives in Afghanistan. I had the pleasure of speaking with Yuli just a few moments before. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Yuli to the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on, and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Thank you.
So before we talk about your book itself, could you please first tell us a little bit about your academic background?
Yes. So originally, I've been trained as a political scientist, in fact. I graduated from Sciences Po in Paris before moving to the UK to pursue a master's degree and then a PhD. So it is at the University of Sussex that I discovered anthropology. And it was a sort of intellectual revelation in the sense that the discipline brought the kind of subtleties that I thought were lacking in political sciences. So, in fact, political scientists often envision politics as being primarily rooted in formal political parties, institutions, while anthropologists bring the politics of the everyday in the picture of the context they study. And this is what was really appealing to me. Mm-hmm. It is also at Sussex that I became interested in gender issues. During my MA, I took a course on gender discourses and relations in Europe, which was taught by Jane Cowen, who later on became my PhD supervisor. So I found the course so fascinating that I chose to write my MA thesis on a Paris-based group of women activists for peace in the Middle East called the Women in Black. I don't know if you've heard of this group before. They are they started, in fact, in Argentina, and then other groups of women in black were created in different places where conflicts had erupted. So in this piece of work, like in my work on Afghanistan, I was interested in observing the various ways in which women become visible in public. That is to say, how women become politically legitimate subjects with a voice of their own. So women in black in Paris gathered once a week on a square in the city center. They were dressed in black, they were holding posters with slogans against the occupation of Palestine. The setting they had created or to stage their protest was inspired from the Madres de la Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires, who organized weekly marches to denounce the disappearance of their sons during the dirty war of the military dictatorship between 76 and 83. So like them, the women in black remained silent. Their presence on the square acted as a public reminder of the conflict and a public reminder of their loss as mothers of Israeli and Palestinian children. Their performance was, consciously gendered. It tapped into nationalist representation of women as mourning mothers, but it also challenged such representation by bringing women in a space traditionally reserved to men, which is the square, the ultimate political arena. So in my with my PhD, I moved away from my hometown, from Paris, and I redirected my focus on Afghanistan because I had spent a year there as a humanitarian worker short after the intervention of the coalition forces in 2003, 2004. So at that time, I was a young graduate, and I didn't know what to do with my life. And like many of us, I ended up working, you know, many of us who've studied in the humanities, in social sciences, I ended up working for an NGO. And because the intervention had been justified by the necessity to put an end to what was called by a human rights activist, the gender apartheid, I thought it would be useful actually to scrutinize what this externally imposed liberation would concretely mean in practice. So the women I met during my first journey in Afghanistan had very little to do with the ones that were described, depicted in the international press. They were not the passive victims of religious fundamentalism. In fact, I found very politically engaged women, extremely resourceful women, who had a lot to say about the future of their country. So my book is an attempt at retrieving these voices and at providing a more accurate representation of the complex reality of their lives under the current occupation.
Wonderful. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about Kabul Carnival more directly. You've given us a wonderful introduction about your inspiration behind why you wanted to go and write this book. Now, the book itself, it's about women and it's about the state, as you've already talked about. But you use this term post-war carnival. So I was wondering, could you first please unpack these three terms a little bit for us? Tell us why the category women emerges as such an important way to understand the state. And what did you mean to capture with this provocative metaphor of the carnival?
Yes, the idea I'm trying to articulate with the metaphor of the carnival is that the current agenda for the empowerment of women is part of a broader humanitarian theater. And I think it's important to reflect on the term theater. We talk about humanitarian theater in Afghanistan. We also talk about a military theater. But I think, it's interesting to try and unpack what term theater means. And I think, this agenda for the empowerment of women serves to promote an impression of normalization for Western audiences, while at the same time hiding the continuity of violence and injustice at the local level. If you remember well, the reconstruction of Afghanistan has been presented to us in the West as a return to normality after long years of war and authoritarian rule. And this discourse has fed the illusion of an absolute reversal from an old order, which was characterized by brutality during the Taliban regime in particular, to a new one characterized by democracy, the rule of law, and gender justice. So here I am referring to the carnivalesque, to the carnival, as defined in the literary work of Mikhail Bakhtin, in his work on Rabelais, in his book Rabelais and His World. So you will perhaps think, what has Rabelais to do with Afghanistan? Well, in fact, I found that it was kind of useful to go back to Bakhtin and to Rabelais and to his description of the carnival in particular. Bakhtin described the carnival as a moment when rules are turned upside down and everything is permitted. It's voiding the borders between actors and spectators. It aims to break down conventions. And in addition, the carnival is supposed to open up opportunities for a new order of things. So during the carnival, still according to Bakhtin, ordinary life rules and hierarchies are temporarily suspended and overturned. So slaves may be crowned as kings, and kings are dethroned and become slaves. Yeah. However, the apparent reversal of roles is aimed at maintaining certain relations of power. So the slave can behave as a king for a while, but by the end of the performance, he will be dead, and the old order will be restored. So the carnival is also structured by rituals. Yet the main goal of rituals of reversal is to remind that power belongs to the role, not to the person who occupies a specific role. So rituals, in this perspective, appear as a public sedative. Indeed, the carnival is the very moment during which, through the apparent subversion, a specific hierarchical order is maintained and even reinforced. So to go back now to the context of Afghanistan, a closer look at the inconsistency, paradoxes and ambiguities that have accompanied the reconstruction, especially in the sensitive arena of gender, reveals that this rhetoric of reversal is a carnivalesque performance in a long history of foreign-led modernization programs disconnected from the social and material reality of the people who are supposed to benefit from it. So in my book, I show that the international community's concern with the visibility of women in public has ultimately created tensions and, in fact, constrained women's capacity to find a culturally legitimate voice. So while the reconstruction has opened up new possibilities for women, the ideological framework on which it is based, that is to say, liberal notions of equality and human rights, together with the strong military presence of foreign troops, have triggered moral panics around identity. So women are on the one hand pressurized by their community to remain faithful to their culture, their religion, their traditions, and they are encouraged at the same time to access the public, become visible, and they are encouraged by the global forces that have joined hands to reconstruct Afghanistan. So they are at the front line of this symbolic battle between competing notions of honor, modernity, democracy, and the place of Islam in society. So they have had to develop, you know, in order to maintain their public presence, they have had to develop alternative ways to preserve some kind of autonomy. And to a great degree, they have had to engage in carnivalesque performance too. So here I'm referring to the more positive aspect of Bakhtin's notion of the carnival, that is to say its regenerative potential, its liberating power. And finally, one major aspect of the so-called reconstruction has focused on state building. Yeah. It's another very important aspect of discussion in my book. So what does state building mean in concrete terms? Well, it has meant mostly providing salaries to the staff employed in ministries, training the police and the army, building buildings for schools and hospitals. But if state infrastructure have been somewhat rebuilt, the traditional Weberian function of the state are shared with a myriad of other actors such as NGOs, UN agencies, the World Bank, private companies, local militias, narco traffickers. So there is a myriad of actors who are sharing, well, not necessarily sharing, but competing also with the state. So most state infrastructures also remain quite dysfunctional because of the lack of trained personnel, because of financial constraints, and also because of widespread corruption. So for all of these reasons, I think it's wrong to do like political scientists do when looking at Afghanistan and to focus on the institution. And it's better to not to move away from analyses that understand the state in terms of apparatus or structures. And it's perhaps more accurate to describe the Afghan state as a ghostly entity. And I use the term phantom state in my book. It's a kind of a ghostly entity whose boundaries remain elusive, porous, and very mobile. But in spite of these, ambiguities, and in spite of the fact that the state is very difficult to grasp, it remains a very powerful object of fantasies for both representative of the international community and ordinary Afghans. There are lots of expectation about what the state should do, especially you know, when it comes to the provision of legal order, of law and order, and when it comes to gender justice in particular. So this tension is, I think, a distinctive feature of this post-colony, which you can find in Afghanistan, but in many other countries in the world. And it is a feature that I'm trying to describe in the book using various ethnographic examples collected in the Afghan judiciary and in the Ministry of Women's Affairs in particular.
Thank you. I mean, what's so interesting as well and is that these sort of topics that you've just talked about now, like in terms of women's bodies and debates about traditional modernity and so on, they're not a new thing to Afghanistan. You talk about this in chapter one, that actually there's been quite a long history of the ways in which bodies have been the sites about debates, which traditional modernity have been played out. So could you please briefly just talk us through some of the main strands of this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the reconstruction, the current reconstruction project in Afghanistan can be placed in a long series of modernization attempts that have been carried out in the 1920s under King Amanullah, who was the king who liberated Afghanistan from the British occupation. And then in the 1960s and 70s under King Zahir Shah, who was very much inspired by other modernization attempts carried out in the Middle East. And then in the 1980s under the communist regime. So all of these modernization attempts were marked by a very strong emphasis on gender issues. In Afghanistan, like in Turkey under Atatürk, or in Syria, Iran, and Iraq, during the same period, the construction of the modern state implied the reshaping of gender relations through state-led programs for the emancipation of women. So to a great extent, the current focus on women mirrors these earlier developments inspired by modernization theory, according to which tradition and cultures were considered as barriers or constraints to development. And indeed, what one often hears in development circles and among the political elite nowadays is that the main barriers to the emancipation of women are to be found in Afghan culture, in Afghan customs and traditions. It's interesting. It's something I heard very often at the Ministry of Women's Affairs, where I spent a little bit of time conducting fieldwork, is that, you know, once traditions, bad traditions are removed thanks to legal reform, then women would become emancipated. And I think these explanations are very problematic because they tend to take for granted the notion of culture as if it could be easily pinpointed, as if Afghan culture had never changed and had never been discussed and it was still not discussed at all. In fact, for me, I consider Afghan culture as a battleground, constantly contested. And interestingly, I recently came across an old tourist guidebook written by a scholar, Nancy Dupre, who spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and is still alive. She spent a lot of time in Afghanistan in the 1970s. And she wrote that guidebook of Kabul, and it was published by the Ministry of Tourism in 1976. And in the last chapter of the guide, a full list of restaurants that serve Afghan wines, together with Kabul nightclubs, is provided. So in these days, going clubbing and drinking wine was part of the Afghan cosmopolitan elite's culture. And this is, to me, a very good illustration, a very good example of how culture is a floating signifier, how it's constantly changing according to political circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you. What I really liked in the second chapter, I liked all of the chapters, but the second chapter is wonderfully called Gender Empowerment Training Program. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, could you talk us through this and in what ways this program was part of the reconstruction effort?
Yes, I decided to write about this training carried out at the Ministry of Women's Affairs precisely because trainings and workshops constitute the core activities of the reconstruction. I mean, it's very difficult to count the number of trainings carried out every day in Kabul because there are too many of them. So I consider these trainings and these workshops as some kinds of rituals that all development actors have to attend in which they have to participate in order to become part of this reconstruction carnival. The one I describe in chapter two is, of course, symptomatic of the gap between the practical needs of ordinary Afghans and the utopian ideals of the international actors involved on the ground. It illustrates particularly well, I think, the values on which the reconstruction is based, namely freedom in the neoliberal sense of the term, according to which the, you know, the individual is the primarily responsible for his own destiny, for his own fate. So in this training, which targeted representative of provincial councils, who are very honorable persons in their regions, people were invited to, you know, do relaxation exercises to the extent that they had to, you know, do some kind of relaxation while, you know, grabbing imaginary apples in the air, and all this in the name of creating a good atmosphere. So there was a kind of clash between the culture from which this American trainer came from and, you know, Afghan culture, where actually, you know, people feel responsible for taking care of their foreign guests. And in spite of the fact that they found it very weird, they really, you know, did their best to participate in the training. And I think it was not only out of politeness that participants tried to do so, but it was also a means, they understood, a means to, you know, become part of development and perhaps later on, you know, gain access to resources of some kind. So this training, even though there is something, I mean, I reckon very humoristic about it. I mean, it could have been filmed. This training, I think, is still very representative of what reconstruction is about. It's very much about, you know, workshops and writing laws. It's very immaterial in many ways.
And that nicely brings us on to thinking a bit about law. I mean, you talk also in the book about this discrepancy between this very public focus on law and order, but then sort of the everyday experience of lawlessness. And so I was wondering, in what ways has the law, both formal and informal, been used in post-war Afghanistan, and to what effect?
Yes, I mean, indeed, if trainings and workshops can be considered as development rituals, I mean, lawmaking is another aspect of this carnival. Law writing and constitution making represent in Afghanistan, and in fact, it is the same in many other countries under state building reconstruction schemes. These activities represent a central effort of the reconstruction. But here again, I mean, as you noted, there is a major gap between the international expectation toward the state and the material reality of Afghan lives. So in order for the state to maintain a semblance of existence, the parliament has been endowed with the duty to write laws. But because the state has no concrete means to enforce the law, the only way for the Afghan polity to assert itself has been through the use of violence and both symbolic or real, and the writing of laws that carry important symbolic power. So ironically, in spite of the fact that quotas have been established for women in the parliament, and there are 25% of women in the parliament now, many of these laws have had to do with controlling women's visibility in public. So I was kind of surprised when I, did some fieldwork in the parliament and observed the meetings of the assembly, to realize that actually a lot of time was spent discussing, you know, the appropriateness of women's dress in public, for instance, and that this was such an important subject that actually it's provided inspiration for writing new laws about how women should dress, for instance, at wedding parties. So the law, which was supposed to be, you know, a source of emancipation, not for Afghan women only, but for all Afghans in general, the law has mostly been used to actually assert authoritarian rule for lack of real capacity from Afghan political actors to do anything else.
Wonderful, thank you. Probably my favorite chapter was the next chapter, which is a discussion about how young, educated Muslim women had to balance between being modern on the one hand and modest on the other. So I was wondering, could you please tell us a little bit about these women, how you came to know them, and the role that religion played in the ways that they negotiated their selfhood?
Yes, I mean, I spent a lot of time. I mean, I spent 4 months in the National Women's Dormitory, which was located on Kabul University campus. And this became one of my major field sites. This dormitory had been renovated with US fundings. And actually, it was the personal project of the American First Lady of the time, Laura Bush. And it was administered by a UN agency, and it was supervised by the Ministry of Higher Education. So there were various actors. Again, that's a good illustration of what I was just talking about earlier, you know, this division of state responsibilities between different actors. So the UN, the US agency, and then the Ministry of Higher Education. And this dorm had the capacity to accommodate about 1,100 female students. But at the time of my fieldwork in 2007, it only accommodated 500 students. And the reason for that was that, again, you know, just to go back to what I said earlier, the reason for that was that the Ministry of Higher Education made it very difficult for young women to actually access this dorm because the ministry, capacity to, you know, provide access was the only capacity that it had, right? And in addition, the dorm was a very controversial space. It was perceived as by the public as a source of foreign pollution. There were lots of gossips around this dorm, and a lot of frustration as well, because boys at the university didn't have a dorm. You know, they had one, but it was falling apart. So only the girls' dormitory had been renovated. So I thought it was a very interesting space because it was a space that was supposed to accommodate the new generation of young women, educated young women, who were going to be, the future of their country. So thanks to the intercession of a student I had recruited as my research assistant and diary teacher, and we boarded in that dorm, I was offered a room there among the female students in return for English and French lessons. So I lived there for 4 months, and I shared girls' daily activities. I improved my diary there, and I gained insight into what made these young women's everyday life. Yeah. So this is the material I use in chapter 4 of the book, where I give an account of the moral dilemmas these young women face when it comes to what to wear. It's not that I decided to focus on clothing, but it appeared that it was a very important subject of discussion. So in this chapter, I demonstrate that even among the young women who try to distinguish themselves from the other young women who had never lived Afghanistan, so even among these young women who had lived in Iran or in Pakistan, so who wanted to be seen as modern, educated, cosmopolitan women, consideration around modesty and Islam remained central in their sartorial choices. And I think that this conformism that dominates in public has less to do with Afghan culture than with the current occupation that has exacerbated inequalities and triggered moral panics around national identity. So women have to, again, you know, kind of weigh and balance on how to present themselves to the world. And none of them wants to be seen as, you know, disrespectful of religion. But they are not, you know, the powerless victims of identity politics. And they are able to mobilize the Afghan cultural imagination in order to render audible claims pertaining to their position in the family, in the community, or in society at large. So they are neither dupes nor revolutionaries. What they often seek tactically, even though they don't have a theory to dress it up, they do would never present themselves as a feminist. But what they seek tactically is to optimize the terms of recognition in their immediate local lives. And this entails a lot of thinking about, you know, what to wear, especially when one is caught in this dilemma of wanting to be both, you know, modern, educated, and a good Muslim, Afghan Muslim girl.
That really is a fascinating discussion in that chapter. Now, let's talk again, maybe not necessarily we can call it clothing, but we'll talk about the veil, because I think one of the most annoying discussions in the Western public sphere is about women wearing the veil, especially in Afghanistan. I mean, when you read any sort of newspaper article, even in supposedly good newspapers, it makes you angry. It makes you wish that more people paid attention to anthropologists like yourself. So one of your arguments in the book is that these liberal ideas about veiling and the supposed lack of agency is misguided. So I was wondering, could you please tell us a little bit about veiling and women in public in Afghanistan?
I mean, you're totally right. I mean, the burqa, which actually, I mean, it's interesting to know that the burqa is not a term that is used in Afghanistan very much. It's called chadori. So the burqa is perceived in the West as the ultimate symbol of women's oppression. And actually, you know, it has been used quite a lot to encourage, gather public support for the intervention. So showing in the media women fully veiled under these burqas was, you know, a means to trigger emotions and popular emotion and to, you know, get the support of the Western public for this intervention. So now what I'm trying to show using ethnographic data collected among mostly women's rights activists and women MPs is that women who are attempting to access the public have had to develop creative strategies of dissimulation to get public recognition. And they have, to a great extent, become visible under the veil, and they are sometimes able to challenge gender hierarchies behind the appearance of compliance and conformity. So what you see is not necessarily what is happening, you know, it's not necessarily what the way we understand it in the West. For example, I understood that there was a huge difference in the choice of veils between female MPs coming from rural areas and female representatives of Kabul. For instance, women who you know, campaigned in rural areas conducted their campaign using the burqa. Mm-hmm. So the burqa was for them kind of a mobile home, to use Laila Abu Lugod's term. I think it's a very good metaphor. It's a mobile home. It was a means to access the public while maintaining the ideal of female modesty. And when they came to the parliament, they came with their burqa, and when they sat in the hemicycle of the National Assembly, they removed it, of course, but they tried to wear headscarves that remained quite neutral. So black was the main color. Whereas female MPs from Kabul didn't have to do that, because in Kabul, you know, the elite doesn't wear any burqa. So it's not a garment that is used, you know, universally everywhere in Afghanistan. And in fact, there are different colors for different regions. So in Kabul, it's mostly blue. If you go to Herat, it's yellow, I think. And if you go to Mazar-e-Sharif, Burqas are white and so on and so forth. So there are also some kind of plays on colors. But I don't want to push that too much. What I want to say is that, you know, women dress differently in different contexts. And in the same way as we would not go to work wearing a swimming suit. And I think it's important to see that, it's very much, decisions are very much taken, of course, taking into consideration, you know, what the family expect from them. But it's also very much a personal, you know, personal decision. And these findings, I think, challenge liberal ideas according to which women's visibility in public spaces is a necessary guarantee for their emancipation and their agency. Because in fact, the burqa again is a means to access the public, is a means to, and actually I was really fascinated by the ways in which, you know, women in bazaars, in markets, who wear the chadori, were able to bargain a lot with merchants, whereas the women who didn't wear any, they really had to put an effort on to actually appear modest, because they were very visible with their face unveiled and covered. And so they had to be, to perform shyness, you know, in order to be, to display an image of a modest woman, in a thought that women wearing the chadori didn't have to make.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, thank you. So now let's move to sort of the last substantive chapter in your book. You make an argument that some suicides in Afghanistan could be seen as expressive or communicative acts. I was wondering, could you please talk us through this idea and by way of this also tell us a little bit about emotion and suffering in the lives of the women you researched amongst?
Yes. The reason why I decided to talk about suicide is because during my fieldwork in 2007, there was a kind of pandemic of women committing suicide through self-immolation. And I was very dissatisfied with the ways in which was this phenomenon was being analyzed and discussed in the press. I mean, most of the explanations were of economic and psychological order. And more rarely, the social dimension was given any place or any role. So in my last chapter, I'm trying to underline the communicative potential of Afghan women's suicide in the post-war reconstruction context. And I'm trying to highlight its ambiguous symbolic power and its anchorage in the subversive imaginary universe of women's political expression, which is a very rich, a very colorful universe. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to argue is that if suicide reproduced certain cultural ideas about women's inherent emotional fragility. It's often the way, you know, locally it is understood. Women are emotionally fragile. Actually, women's suicide also challenge the honor system in powerful ways and opens up possibilities for voicing discontent. So I think it can be seen as what Certeau calls the art of the weak, as a covert form of protest, as a kind of a performance that builds upon traditional popular knowledge about gender in order to manage the impression of an audience and make women's claims audible. And I'm using actually the example of two young women who became my friend during my fieldwork, who were sisters, and who both attempted suicide one after the other. Both of them were quite young and were engaged in very unconventional activities for women in the Afghan context. One was a singer, the other one was a kung fu champion. This family had lived in exile in Iran for a very long time and had returned to Afghanistan after the invasion. And while in Iran, it was completely possible for them to actually be a singer and a kung fu champion. When they returned to Afghanistan, the family had lost their house. The father was unemployed. And suddenly, it became a dishonor that they were involved in such activities. It became a dishonor to the family. So each of them decided to swallow pills one after the other. I mean, in 2 weeks' time, this occurred. And I don't think that this young woman, whom I knew very personally, really wanted to put an end to their lives, even though I'm not saying that they were really happy with their lives, but I don't think they wanted to die. So I'm trying to place this story, in the imaginary universe of this dorm where young women spend a lot of time reading poetry. And actually, they were reading poetry written by Afghan women. And actually, this poetry, the poetry of Nadia Anjuman, the poetry of Rabia Balkhi, who are very famous Afghan poets, even though they are separated by several hundred years. This poetry was very much about suicide, about sacrifice, about women's capacity to endure. And then I realized that actually, after a while, I understood that the main capacity of a woman, the one that is the most value, is her capacity to sacrifice herself for the family, for the community. So I think, they were kind of capitalizing on this popular imagination in order to bring claims, to get a voice. This is what I'm trying to explain in this last chapter.
Thank you. Now, I've shot through this book. It's a very rich book, very quickly. So I was wondering if there's anything that I've missed that you'd like to highlight for those who've not yet had the chance to read the book.
Well, I think, the main purpose of this book, again, is to provide a more accurate picture of the situation of women in Afghanistan, is to bring a bit of nuance and also to pay homage to their extreme resourcefulness. And it's also, the issue of women is, to me, an entry point into the broader reconstruction exercise. And I think it's an important one because it has been the one that has been brought to the fore in order to justify this intervention and to justify the occupation and the prolongation of this occupation as well. So for people who are interested in gender issues, I think they will find many similarities with older context, even a colonial context of the situation of women in colonial Algeria, for instance. So even for historians, they will find many similarities with this other context. And for people who are interested in Afghanistan, well, actually, there are very few books, anthropological books on women. There are many, but not of an anthropological, from an anthropological perspective. So this is also a public I'm trying to address.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I think it does this really well. So now that this book is out, I know we talked just before we started recording, you have a young son. So I asked this with slight trepidation, what are your current and future projects?
So besides taking care of my son, which is almost a full-time job,
of course.
I'm trying to, I'm engaged in two research projects. One has to do with Islam in Europe and in particular the UK, where you're from, Ian. And I'm looking at, Islamic legal culture of Britain, looking at different places where something like Islamic legal culture of the UK is taking shape. So I've been looking at Sharia Council, but also legal firms that, are specializing in Islamic law, and there are many of them. But also, the UK is an interesting place for Islamic finance now. It's perhaps the first in Europe. So these different places where something like an Islamic legal culture is taking roots. That's one project. And then the other one is a research project looking at international governance at the UN, and in particular a new human rights monitoring mechanism called the Universal Periodic Review, which has been put in place when the UN Human Rights Council has been reformed recently. So this is a project I'm carrying out with my former PhD supervisor, Jane Cowan, which allows me to also spend a bit of time in Geneva, where my family is based. Wonderful. So very different from Afghanistan, as you can see.
Yes. Well, to Geneva. Wonderful. Yeah. Thanks so much for this discussion. I've really enjoyed talking about your book, and I really enjoyed reading it. I think it's, like you mentioned before, I think it speaks to lots of different debates in many different ways, and really is a fascinating read as well. So I'd like to recommend the book to everybody listening at home. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ian.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about Kabul Carnival by Yuli Biao. This book is absolutely wonderful. I strongly recommend it, and I hope you listen again next time. Ta-ra!